welcome to the fifth episode of Homer Grown. This is a bi-weekly show about gardening, agriculture, and local producers meant to encourage, empower, and educate gardeners. We strive to provide diverse voices by interviewing experts and garden enthusiasts. Although the name of this show is Homer Grown, our goal is to provide information relevant and applicable to the broader Kenai Peninsula. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. For this episode, the focus is water conservation. What do you remember about last summer? I remember. The village of Nanwalek ran out of water. The entire state of Alaska was engulfed in flames. The Swan Lake fire burned for months. I was working three jobs and also picking up side gigs. The farm that I live on ran out of water. Public radio lost all funding on the state level. The coronavirus aside, this year, everything seems different. At least except for one. The memory of water uncertainty pushes me to prepare for future water shortages. Water is life. For today's episode, we talk to Don McNamara, owner of Oceanside Farms, about rain catchment systems for high tunnels and irrigation systems. We speak with local hydrologist Mike Gratz on how to construct an extensive rain catchment system for your home or farm operation, as well as local hydrology. Pam Voller, district conservationist for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, shares ways NRCS can assist local farmers in improving their water practices. As usual, Kyra Wagner from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District has our Tech Minute. Let's get started. Can you please introduce yourself?
I'd like to welcome you all to Oceanside Farms. My name is Don McNamara. I'm the owner, and my sweet wife is off doing paperwork. Her name is Donna Ray.
How big is this farm?
It's just at 5 acres of mixed vegetable and fruits.
So the subject of this show is related to water issues. I'm curious how you maintain the watering of these fields and the high tunnels.
Watering has been a real struggle here on the bench in Homer. So the water on East End Road is pretty hit and miss if you're going to dig a well. It's going to be probably full of iron. So really not fit for human consumption without $1,000 or $2 in filter systems. So we tried not to do a well for the first 4 years, and then we finally gave up and had a well drilled last spring. Thank you, Jeff. The first year we dug a couple spring boxes. If you keep 3 feet of soil over the top of your spring box, then the bacteria cannot get through it. And so your water will be cleansed just by running through the soil instead of needing the chlorine and the ultraviolet. It's been a long learning curve. And the second year we dug a pond and set up rain catchment. 1 inch of rain, 1,000 feet of roof structure is 600 gallons. And so we have four high tunnels tied into a 1,000 gallon tank. We don't catch it all because our system's not perfect, but we'll get... The other day we got 2,000 gallons, so we filled the tank twice.
I'm wondering if you could describe your water catchment system on your high tunnels.
Our high tunnels are on a 5-degree slope, and we have roll-up sides. And so instead of rolling up the sides inward, as the manufacturer recommends, we rolled them outwards, and that made a gutter down the whole 70-foot length of the high tunnel. And then we run it into 4-inch PVC pipe, and tied them all together, tying into a 1,000-gallon tank at the bottom of the hill.
And so is that all gravity-fed?
That's all gravity-fed, and then we have a pump at the tank, and that runs into another pump, which runs up the hill. So it's quite a Goldberg operation, if you want the truth. But it's working for us.
A Goldberg operation?
Band-Aids here and there to make it all work, whatever we could find. With the roll-up sides, they have a pole. If everybody's familiar with the roll-up side on a high tunnel, and the pole, I cut the PVC pipe with a long slit in it, and so it's an upright with a T onto the horizontal line going to the tank. So the water runs into that horizontal pipe with the slit in it and then goes into the T and then down the hill. Yeah, it works pretty darn good. It's perpendicular to the long angle of the 5% slope is where we're catching the water. The pipe is not perfectly straight or anything like that, so we do get some water running off here and there. It's not a perfect world.
Last year, on the farm that I live, we had problems during July because there was no water. Do you remember what last year was like for you?
Last year was a drought, complete drought. I was watering every 3 days instead of every day like I like to water. The plants didn't seem to mind. Plants are much tougher than you really think. If you can get some water to them, they will be great. If anybody remembers the sunflower seed field last year, we watered that never. And so I was worried that they wouldn't grow, but we started them late enough that they kind of got into the rainy season before they really produced seeds and flowers. This year, the sunflowers are down on the east side of our property, and we have not watered those since May.
During that time last year, did you have to supplement water?
We bought a couple truckloads of water last year, which is not feasible for a small farm to be able to afford that.
Can you think of any plants that don't require a lot of water?
I think everybody likes water. We have not been able to water our apple trees, and they're still thriving. And so I think a deeper root system would be the kind of plants you want, like the sour dock does quite well. One time we tried to heat our high tunnel high enough to kill the horsetail. Good luck with that. Their roots go down 6 feet. And there was just a little pool of water around each spurg of horsetail coming out of the ground in a 130 degree temperature high tunnel.
Do you do anything to prepare your beds in order for them to retain more water?
Definitely want to compost. Organic matter is the name of the game. It builds soil structure and adds a bit of cushion to your moisture content. It's like a big sponge.
Can you talk to us about your pond?
We dug a small pond here at Oceanside Farms. The one good thing about East End Road is there's a bit of clay content in the soil, so it really holds water well. The usual backhoe that you can rent digs about 12 to 13 feet deep, and so that's what we did. We rented a hoe, dug about a 30 by 30 pond, and it's as deep as the hoe would dig. It hasn't sloughed in at all. The bottom's filled in a little bit just from erosion from up above. I would say it'll take you a few minutes to learn how to run the hoe, and then after that you'll be fine. It's a pond, so it doesn't have to be level, plumb, or square, and the bottom doesn't have to be flat. We kind of sloped ours so if someone did fall in, they could walk their way out. So for safety's sake.
What does your irrigation system look like?
We're irrigating, I would say, 3/4 of the property with drip irrigation. Last year we ran 2 miles of pipe around the property, so it might look like spaghetti lines to someone who didn't know, but it's working quite well. We have one pump that puts out from 3 to 16 gallons a minute, so we can really throw a lot of water anywhere we need rather quickly. We have zones, probably around 5,000 square feet is a zone, and we have 1, 2, 3, 9, 10, 11, 12. We have about 12 zones, and they take about 200 to 400 gallons a zone per day.
Is your drip irrigation manual or on a timer?
The pump is not a smart pump, so it doesn't know when the pressure gets up to 50 to turn off. So we have to control it manually. So we have to walk around the farm and turn each zone on and off independently.
How do your watering practices differ between the high tunnels and in the fields?
So our watering practices are the tunnels get water every day. The outside gardens, we kind of put our hand out, and if it's wet, then we know not to water, and if it's dry, we give them a little drink.
Do you have any advice for beginning gardeners on how to better conserve water?
So to make the best use of your water that you do have, drip irrigation is definitely the way to go. Before we got the pumps and all the water lines last year, we were using it on a gravity basis, which worked pretty good. It just doubled the zones that we had, so we would water about 1,000 square feet instead of, you know, 2,000 square feet in drip, just because we're all on a slope and all the water would go to the bottom of the field instead of making it to the top. Now we have all pressurized lines, so we're running about 12 pounds of pressure, and we can water about 5,000 square feet per zone, which helps a bunch. And so conserving your water usage, I would say, yeah, add organic matter to your soil is going to be your best bet. And then drip irrigation is going to be your next best use of the water that you do have.
Okay, so can you settle a bet for me? I get into an argument with my farm mates about when is the best time to water.
I would say the best time to water is when the plants are thirsty. And the most practical time of the day to water is in the evening, just because its evaporation is much slower in the evening time. But I think the plants are a little bit more dormant because they're not photosynthesizing as much in the evening, so they don't really need the water as much as they did earlier in the day when they were working hard. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'll see the sugar content in the leaves of the plants go up probably 2 bricks from the morning when they were waking up from their night slumber.
That's not the answer that I wanted.
what was your answer?
I think that it's best to water in the morning because there might be some evaporation, but if you do it early enough, then the plants are getting the water that they need, and then they're able to use that and photosynthesize with the sun. And I don't know, I'm not a expert or anything, but I also think that when you water at night, it can encourage different things like slugs. But there's also other ways to keep out the slugs too.
Yes, I think you're correct there, and watering in the morning would be the most ideal time, but evaporation would be a little bit higher. Like I said, that would be the most efficient time for the plant to get water because they're going to be working hard all day long photosynthesizing. And as far as the slug problem, get ducks. They are so cool. They'll run around this whole place. They'll cover 2 acres in 45 minutes just by running around and eating slugs as fast as they can. They travel in a little pack, and then I say, okay, go to bed, and they all just make a single file line and head for their pen.
The ducks understand you?
They understand a few words. Do it last thing before I go in, so when the slugs start showing up, I let the ducks out. And
the ducks don't hurt the plants?
They are tromplers, so they got big feet, and so you wouldn't want to let them into a freshly transplanted lettuce bed, but if you had them in your broccoli field, they'll just walk in and out between the plants, and the garlic is another good one, that they'll just walk around the plants.
Is there anything that I might have missed that you would like to talk about?
So I would just like to remind everybody that water safety is truly important. We bring city water out to the farm to wash our vegetables, the ones that we do wash, and the vegetables that we don't have to wash. We mention it to our customers that you should wash your vegetables when you get them home, and that goes for everybody, even buying at the farmer's market. Take good care of them.
That was Don McNamara talking to us on July 21st, 2020, on his farm, Oceanside Farm, on East End Road. Up next, Kyra Wagner has our Tech Minute.
Hello, this is Kyra Wagner from Homer, Soil & Water for today's Tech Minute. When it comes to water use, one of the most important things to take into consideration with your plants inside your greenhouse or your high tunnel is that they get enough water. Indoors, you are in control of the watering system, so you can run around with a watering can. But if you want to have something that's a little bit more controlled, you can implement some higher technologies. You need to be careful so you're not creating too much water inside of your building. That'll equate to mold. But if you don't put enough in there, especially if you have any additional peat in your soils, they can get so hard that they're impermeable when you do water. So making sure that your plants have good amounts of water and at the right time of the day is really important. One of the best little bits of technology is a timer. Seems like a really simple idea, but they can get really complicated. You can set them up so that they control entire zones of irrigation, micro-irrigation like drip tape with special emitters that put the water exactly on the plant that you want, or maybe just a general soaker hose that makes sure that that particular bed gets plenty of water. There is one thing to consider if you have a really complex system like this. There are low-pressure timers as well as ordinary high-pressure timers. Every timer will say what kind of PSI it requires to function properly. So if you're watering your high tunnel or your garden with a gravity feed system, you'll need to make sure that you have enough pressure to get that timer to kick off right. And always make sure that the batteries are on, because if they're not functioning, you may leave for a while and not have the reliability of having your timer watering for you. But if all goes well and your pressure and your batteries are all up, you can have an amazing system functioning and raising your garden without you ever lifting a watering can. This has been Kyra Wagner with today's Tech Minute.
Coming up next, we talk with local hydrologist Mike Grotz on how to construct an extensive rain catchment system for your home or farm operation and hydrology of local wetlands.
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Mike Grotz. I've lived in Homer about 30 years. I've had a rainwater catchment system for 15. I got a PhD, believe it or not, in conservation sciences. I studied the ecohydrology, how water moves through wetlands, especially in the Cook Inlet Basin.
So what does a hydrologist do?
What I was interested in my narrow hydrology study is, do peatlands, the wetlands around here, which are mainly peatlands, contribute water stream flow during the dry period, during the summer dry period? The common knowledge was, well, of course they do. But the hydrologists all in the literature were saying, no way, that's a myth, doesn't happen. The water table is too high all the time. There's not enough storage. But I found that around here they do. I did a pretty convincing study on the Anchor River that showed that using a mixing model. And so in certain, what they call hydrogeologic settings, peatlands do contribute during the dry season quite a bit, over half the flow, and was coming from the surface water in these wetlands in this watershed.
You work for the Kenai Watershed Forum?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
What role do you have, and what does the refuge do as an organization?
Oh, the Watershed Forum, you know, their main focus was fish passage, replacing culverts that were barriers to fish migration. They got all the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. They've done a few other big projects and stream restoration projects. The closest one to Homer was on the North Fork Road, just west of town, where a gravel pit had mined in the floodplain of the Anchor River, and there was the floods in 2002, and the river had jumped into the gravel pit, and the Watershed Forum came and restored that site using a natural channel design. So that's their big focus. They work on introduced species and environmental ed, too, trying to eradicate invasive species. I got associated with them because I was mapping wetlands, and I mapped all the wetlands from here to Denali Park, basically, that are on private lands. That's what you see when you go to the borough's parcel viewer. You see that wetland map is my fault. Most people are thankful because it is useful information to have to know.
Why do you say my fault?
Yeah, because some people think that, you know, I made wetlands. But yeah, I'm not popular with everyone for that. You know, you can imagine people would be mad. I'm sorry. I don't mean to have your deal fall through. If the buyer finds out it's wet, I think that's a good thing. Because it's wet doesn't mean you can't build there. It just means it's going to be more expensive and you're going to have to put more thought in it. You're going to have to battle the water table, essentially. And around here, it's not always obvious that places are wet. So the map was a big upgrade from what we had before, and it's served online, so it's easy. And, you know, it's mapped at a pretty coarse scale. So when you're looking at a 5-acre lot or a 2-acre lot, you know, you have to use some judgment. That was the whole idea behind the wetland map, too, is there were some big high-profile mistakes. There was a, I think it's a Lutheran or Methodist church just west of town. You know, it was forest there, and no big deal. It was mapped. The soils guys mapped it as peat. It was wet. Peat is just a deep layer of organic matter that you can't really build on. And that's what it was, you know, even though there were big trees growing on it. And so it cost them a year and $300,000 to deal with that. So it's not like the regulatory framework of building on a wetland is going to stop you. You just have to know it's there and know how to deal with it properly. Or not. So, you know, it seems like, oh, I got a cheap piece of land. Great. You know, I can build a bigger house or whatever. But often there's no free lunch, unfortunately. You know, that land is cheap because it's going to be more expensive to deal with the water that's there.
Moving on to wells and well water. Many people are concerned about arsenic in the well water. Can you talk about this?
We have high arsenic in our well, 148 parts per billion. The EPA standard now is 10. And the old standard, when we discovered our high arsenic, was 50. And along our street, you know, I was kind of the first one to find out. So other people started testing their wells. My neighbor has the highest in the Cook Inlet Basin that I know of, over 200 parts per billion. It's mainly in the glacial till. So if you have a well that's finished in glacial till around here, there's a chance there's arsenic in it. And if you haven't had it tested, test it. I drank it for 6 years, and there is a dose-related response to arsenic levels in your well water and the incidence of certain types of cancer, and I had one of those types of cancer. And so it probably was from the well water, but can't be sure. I'm fine. You know, I had surgery, and that was almost 20 years ago, so it worked out. But it made me not want to drink well water anymore at my house. You know, some well water is great. If you're below the glacial till, which like up on Diamond Ridge, most of the people that have wells up there are in the tertiary deposits, which is now the neogene deposits. That doesn't have arsenic in it. I don't know if there is any. But glacial till is, you know, it's a common place. It usually supplies a lot of good quantity of water. You just have to make sure there's no arsenic in it.
So I live at the bottom of a hill. Actually, we're neighbors.
Right.
My water is basically a drainage ditch. I'm wondering what kind of contaminants might be present from the neighbors that live above me, and should I be concerned?
Yeah, I think I would be. It's good to test always, but you have to know what to test for. You know, septic systems are kind of the first worry people have, and they're not too much of a worry when you have lot sizes that are bigger than about 2 acres, you know, unless you're well was right in your neighbor's drain field or something like that. But, you know, in sand within like 20 feet or so of the drain field, you're going to get rid of most of that biological contamination. It's not really going to be significant. So what you do have to worry about, though, is, you know, does your neighbor change his oil in his driveway? You know, does he have a lot of heavy equipment that leaks hydraulic fluid or brake fluid? Maybe there's some legacy of a underground fuel tank that's leaking, which is a real common problem in the area that, you know, nobody knows about. So yeah, those are things to worry about from your neighbors. And then, you know, around here, you know, because you're my neighbor, arsenic is a worry. Maybe never has the surface water contained enough arsenic to be worrisome here. But if that drainage ditch is carrying like footer drain water and other groundwater, that could have arsenic in it because that's groundwater.
Tell me something about water that fascinates you.
You know, there's an interesting study that looked at, I don't know, tens of thousands of sites all over the world in every kind of ecosystem, in deserts and tropical rainforests and temperate forests, grasslands, everywhere. They looked at water, and they looked at the isotopic composition of the water. It's naturally occurring stable isotopes. You know, there's no radioactivity or anything involved here. But water has different types of molecules, different types of hydrogen and oxygen atom. And that leaves a signature, kind of a fingerprint. And they divided the water up in the four categories: precip, you know, rain and snow, surface water, you know, streams and lakes, groundwater, water that's in plants. So there's a four categories, you know, plants, groundwater, surface water, and rainwater. And they found that there were two pairs that were really similar to each other. What would you guess they would be? They were plant water and rainwater, and groundwater and surface water were really similar across all ecosystems. So in other words, groundwater, your well water, and surface water are really kind of the same water. That's how water gets in streams through the ground. You know, it rains and the stream comes up, and it comes up fast, and it seems too fast for the ground to convey that volume of water into the stream flow. But it does. Studies again and again have shown this. Essentially, the water that's flowing in response to the big rainfall, the big flood, most of that water is groundwater that's flowed over long flow paths. And then you think about, well, plant water and rainwater are almost the same. That means plants, when it rains, they suck up as much water as they can and then just kind of hold on to it. They're not getting a lot from groundwater. They're storing it in between rainstorms. And hydrologists were baffled by this because the models, you know, well, they could predict stream flow based on rain, but they didn't know what happened in between. You know, you go into the forest and it's pouring down rain. You don't see water flowing across the soils. It must flow along preferential flow paths around root channels and big pore spaces. But it's pushing, you know, the old water out like a hydraulic system, you know, like on your backhoe. You pull the lever, it pushes on the hydraulic fluid and lifts the bucket. And the same thing, the rain falls into the soil and pushes that water out into the stream. So the old water, been in the ground for a while, is what's flowing in the stream in response to the rain. Of course, you know, some water falls directly on the stream and from the rainstorm and nearby the stream and flows in across the surf where it's at the surface in the floodplain. Most stormwater in response to a rain event is old water. And they've done a lot of studies on this to show, and it's pretty convincing. But it's counterintuitive, right? You see the creek rise so fast in response to the pouring down rain, that water's got to be that rain, right? You know, but it's not. It's being pushed through the ground.
I don't think any of my questions can really follow that one.
That's okay.
So I just wanted to go back to a previous question. If my water does contain arsenic, can I use it to water plants that I consume?
Some plants will selectively uptake arsenic and some won't. I think most won't. But you know, I consider the same thing. I got a well sitting right in my garden, and I pipe water from a little stream by gravity to water my garden because I'm not sure. There haven't been exhaustive studies on every plant and does it uptake arsenic and concentrate arsenic. So, yeah, I'm not sure. Do my onions do it and my lettuce doesn't? I don't know.
Do you know of an example of a plant that does uptake arsenic?
Not off the top of my head. They do use plants in remediation, and there are certain species that they plant to uptake heavy metals. Usually they're worried about chromium. I assume that they would uptake arsenic too, but I don't know for sure.
So our city water comes from the reservoir. Do you know what is added to the water before it comes into our taps?
Yeah, that'd be a good question for the folks at the water treatment plant, okay, for sure. But I know they added chlorine for sure. And man, you know, I do rainwater catchment, and every once in a while, like this year, I had to have a delivery of city water. And I walked into my basement and I right away was overwhelmed with the smell of chlorine. I was like, whoa. But, you know, I'm used to no chlorine at all. So when you even get a little bit, you really notice it.
Do you do anything to off gas?
Right. I don't worry too much about the city water, you know, because it's already suitable for drinking. But every once in a while, I have just when my rainwater catchment tanks are low, you know, I haven't cleaned them in a while, and I'm going away for a month or something, I'll put a pretty heavy dose of chlorine in the tanks and then go away and then just let them off gas in those couple weeks or month.
I want to talk about your water catchment system. And first, I want to know how it got to this point. What kind of trial and error did you experience?
Other people did that for me, thank goodness. Lassa Holmes gave me a book on rainwater catchment. And in that book, it tells you how to calculate how much water you're going to receive and how to size your system. And it's area specific, you know, so it's different for Seward than it would be for Homer. In fact, even it's a little different for me out in Fritz Creek than it would be for someone in town. We get a little more rain out here. And it really depends on the volume of rain and how it's distributed through the year. So we have a dry period in the summer, and then during the winter, you know, we'll have periods where we won't get any snow melt. And so for around here, get your pencils and paper out, because if you're considering doing this, you're going to want to know this. You get a gallon of water per month per square foot of catchment that you have. So that's the footprint of your roof. And I catch off my house and my shed, so I have about 2,000 square feet of catchment, so I can get about 2,000 gallons a month. But to get that all year round, I have to have about four times that in storage. So that's about 8,000 gallons of storage, which is a lot of space. You need a lot of space to make it work. And I've had my system for 15 years, and I've had maybe six or seven deliveries. One this year, two last year. Nevertheless, we get dry periods. And then, you know, before that, I don't think I had a delivery for 6 or 7 years. So it works, but you need a lot of catchment.
How many gallons of water do your tanks store?
So I have three 2,500-gallon tanks and a 300-gallon tank. And normally the 300-gallon tank is just pumping 100 gallons or 50 gallons or so, somewhere in that neighborhood at a time, into the 7,500 gallons of storage. But when I get completely full, that 300-gallon tank will fill all the way up. So I'll have 7,800 gallons of storage and a little less than 2,000 square feet of catchment footprint.
So the 300-gallon tank is kind of the middleman?
Yeah, he is. He does a great job. He's worth his money.
What about the other components?
If you'll need a metal roof. You wouldn't want a tar paper roof. Then, you know, contamination from the tar might be a concern too. Probably cedar shingles would work, but they absorb a fair amount of water, so you won't get quite as much as your gallon per month. But metal roofs work pretty well. And then also the big issue with doing catchment for your water supply is organic material, leaves and needles and pollen. And so you need a filtration system to kind of deal with that, especially the first flush off your roof. You need to somehow deal with those cone scales and bud scales and leaves and whatever else that end up in your water supply. And there are a number of filter systems that help deal with that. Then you need some other filters and maybe a standpipe to allow settling. A small tank at the beginning is really handy. That's easy to clean out and can take anything that your initial filter misses before it goes into your main tanks. And, you know, you're going to have a lot of storage, right? Because you're doing rainwater and it's seasonal around here. So you'll have more than one tank. So make one of them small so you can easily clean it. And then you'll need something at the end, a fine sediment filter followed by a UV sterilizer. I guess some people would use chlorine. I don't know why. It's a lot of maintenance and the UV sterilizer isn't that much.
So you said that this is seasonal. When do you stop collecting rainwater? Is it just when it snows or when you...
No, I collect it every chance it rains. I'll always be collecting it. When readout went off, I turned it off to get rid of the ash. I have a valve I can just shut off and it all flows out. But the seasonal part is that it just doesn't rain in May and June very much, or you won't get much snowmelt in February.
Does the pitch or the design of the roof matter?
No, not really. I guess it can't really be flat. The water has to flow off of it. And then as far as the design, it's mainly the material, you know, and a metal roof is best.
How much would somebody estimate spending if they wanted to put in a simple rain catchment system?
I'm a science guy, you know, so what do science guys say to questions like that? It depends, which isn't a very satisfactory answer. But think about what you're going to do anyway. So if you're going to have a metal roof anyway, and you're going to have gutters anyway, and you're going to take delivery from the city for your water supply anyway, so you have a tank, and maybe even you'll have a filter after the tank, even for city water. Maybe you just want a carbon filter or a little sediment filter, because who knows what's in the truck. So you have most of the components anyway installed. So if you have that, and you have storage for one tank, then it's how much extra storage can you fit in your space? That's kind of the biggest expense, is having that heated storage, because, you know, it can't freeze in the winter time. But if you have that space, then all you're really talking about is maybe another filter or two, maybe another pump or two, and another tank or two. So then it's, you know, on the order of an elaborate system like mine, I think the whole thing was like $30,000. And that's three tanks and a UV filter and a couple of pumps, the plumber to install it, and the guy to put the gutters up. But, you know, if you already have those tanks and a pump and maybe a filter, then, you know, the cost of two more tanks and another filter and maybe a UV sterilizer. The UV sterilizer is about $1,000. The initial sediment filter shipped from Maryland is around $350. Maybe it's $400 now. Tanks are expensive now. When I did my system, they were about $1 a gallon, and now I think they're closer to $2 a gallon. So if you want to have 8,000 gallons of storage, you know, there's $16,000 in tanks. Maybe you don't need that much, or maybe you can get a deal. I would shy away from used tanks that you don't know what was in them before.
Have you encountered any issues with your water catchment system?
No, just running out. There's one thing I would do differently. I had standpipes originally that were set pretty high in my tanks. So when I was empty, I had 1,100 gallons of water. And a lot of people, that's almost full. You know, some people, if you have a 1,500 gallon tank, 1,100 gallons, you're sitting well. But I was almost empty, so I would have to pump water from two of my tanks into the final tank so that I could access, you know, maybe 600 or 800 gallons of that 1,000 gallons of water. So I lowered my standpipes. So that was one thing. You know, you don't need a whole lot of settling in your tanks if you take care of the organics at the beginning. The settling zones don't have to be that deep. And then another thing, well, it was kind of handy to use that pump to pump from those other tanks, even with the smaller settling zones. So if you could somehow think about that in the beginning and make it easy, just unscrew one fitting and screw in another fitting and flick the switch and be able to pump water from one tank to another, that would be handy. But now we're splitting hairs.
Let's say I just had raw land and I wanted to be self-sufficient in regards to water. What are some steps that I would want to think about in planning a structure?
Yeah, that's storage. You know, if you're lucky, you have a good surface water source or a good well water source. It's not so common around Homer. So if you don't have those things, then you have to think about how much water am I going to use? How much do I need per month? And where am I going to store four times that amount? In Fairbanks, there's some systems that they tarp a hillside because it's really dry in Fairbanks, but they get snow and the snow stays all winter. So if you tarp a huge area of hillside and in the spring that water will melt off, and if you can catch that water and store it for the summer, you can use it to irrigate your garden, for example, or as house water if you have a lot of storage. Essentially, those systems, you're relying on a one-time event to catch all your water for the year.
Shifting gears, in regards to water, is there anything that a landowner could do to protect local fish habitat?
Yeah, probably the best thing is a buffer, you know, around wetlands and fish streams. If you just pay attention to that and don't disturb the vegetation right up to the stream, you'll go a long way. Your road runs parallel with the slope, so it's intersecting water flowing down the slope, like East End Road does along the edge of the bluffs. You know, it intercepts water, flows in the ditch, it goes through a culvert under the road, and then discharges somewhere. That water's not too big a deal. That's just an example. But if it discharged into a stream, and that stream is connected to a salmon stream, when the water's in the ditch, it'll warm up. And then it'll go under the culvert as warm water. And then if it discharges into a salmon stream that has, you know, juvenile fish in it, just a tiny little stream, as long as it's connected to the Anchor River or Beaver Creek or something, that warm water will stress those juvenile fish. And it's not a very difficult fix. All you have to do is where the culvert discharges, before it gets to the stream, put some gravel or something to allow the water to infiltrate back into the soil before it discharges into the stream. And it can be, you know, 50 or 100 feet as little as some places it might take 500 or 600 feet of infiltration before it discharges into the stream to cool that water back down so you're not discharging warm water into the stream. So, you know, a little French drain type thing at the discharge point of the culvert would help a lot. Also, you know, if you have to put a culvert in, this is the biggest impact on fish is culverts for driveways. And a driveway isn't just your driveway, it's the access to your house, you know, so the road that you turn off of on your driveway and the road that connects to that, to the main road. And so all that network of roads has culverts in it. And if those culverts perch water, go over a stream and the water flows in a little waterfall out the end, you know, the culvert hangs, the juvenile fish will wash down and won't be able to get back upstream again, and they'll lose habitat that way. It, you know, along the Homer Bluff, it's not so big a deal because there aren't many fish streams, but if you're connected to the Anchor River, then it is a big deal. You know, this is how we lose our fish populations, just one by one little, you know, it's not a big catastrophe out in the ocean. It's not a huge overfishing event usually. It's just habitat loss, these little tiny thousand cuts, so to speak, of habitat loss.
Is there anything that I've missed?
Yeah, tons.
Well, let's hear it.
But no, this is good.
Any last thoughts?
Good job. Thanks for doing this show. I enjoyed it, and I hope you keep it going. All right.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah.
That was Mike Grotz. We spoke on July 22nd, 2020, at his home in Fritz Creek, Alaska. Mike wanted the listening audience to know that he is available to offer assistance and answer questions if you are considering a water catchment system. You can call him at 235-3788. Up next, Nicole Arevalo talks to Pam Voller on ways NRCS can assist local farmers in improving their water practices.
Hi, this is Nicole from Homer Soil and Water. I'm here today speaking with Pam Voller, District Conservationist for the Natural Resources Conservation Service here in Homer. Pam, can you begin by introducing what NRCS is and what you guys do?
NRCS is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We work with landowners. We offer both technical and financial assistance. Of the farmers that we work with on the peninsula are small-scale growers, but we work with people who have larger acreages as well, and people who, other than growing vegetables or fruits or cut flowers, people that have pasture land, forest land, hay, or even rangeland. We provide conservation planning assistance and can help identify natural resource needs on your operation. That includes water conservation. Water conservation doesn't simply mean using as little water as possible. It means using water as efficiently as possible to meet the needs of your crops and your production goals without using more water than is needed.
Pam, can you tell us about some of your irrigation practices? How can NRCS help people with irrigation?
So first, I'd like to talk about the benefits of having an irrigation system designed for your farm. Locally, most of the systems designed by NRCS include micro-irrigation, so that water is delivered directly to plant roots and not to the walkways or between rows or sprayed out beyond the boundary of your field. We also often include or actually require that people do irrigation water management. For one thing, if you apply too much water to your field, it can result in erosion. With the runoff from your field, you can be carrying nutrients or pesticides. So with an irrigation system, it can help you apply only as much water as is needed at a rate that allows the water to infiltrate into the soil and not run off. Another benefit of good irrigation system is that it can improve plant health. It can help you keep from overwatering or underwatering or even having uneven distribution. I know I used to have a micro irrigation system and I finally figured out that I didn't have enough pressure and I wasn't getting the water distributed evenly across my garden. And that's why one bed consistently didn't do as well as all the others. You know, I thought, oh, the soil must be different there. No, it turned out they weren't getting the water like all the rest of the beds. If you have a good irrigation plan, it can save a lot of time and labor.
And so in what ways does NRCS assist people in getting these irrigation systems?
We go out on the land with people if they're interested in working with us. We look around the property and talk about what people want to do out there and if they have resource concerns. We can provide technical assistance and help figuring out how to install a good irrigation system for the property, or we can provide some financial assistance if they're interested. Some of things like pipeline, flow meter, so you can see how much water you've applied, a filter, even a pump, if you don't have a pump or if it's inefficient. Micro irrigation system, we can help with installing that in your crop field. And sometimes we also include a reservoir, and generally that means some kind of above ground tank. That works for some people because our wells may not produce enough water to where we can actually irrigate a large area directly from our well. If you have a reservoir that you can fill at low demand time on your well, then you can completely irrigate your area, hopefully at once, and not damage your well. We also usually suggest groundwater testing. That's mostly to see if there are components in your groundwater that might clog up any kind of micro irrigation system.
Like what?
Oh, sometimes just certain minerals. I don't have my list right handy, but just things that might settle out in your lines and around the emitters out of whatever your micro irrigation system is and start to plug them.
Another component are these tensiometers. Can you describe what those are?
Yeah, and that's a really important part. As I said before, there are certain concerns we have with over or under applying water. So we require irrigation water management. And part of that is you need to install soil moisture sensors around your field and record the levels of moisture in your soil before you irrigate and after you irrigate. The point of that is people start to learn just how much water is in their soil, how much water they need to apply. For instance, if you install a moisture meter at 6 inches and one at 12 inches, if the one at 12 inches becomes soaked, is saturated after you irrigate, you most likely have put too much water on your crops because it's out of reach of most of the roots of the plants that we grow around here. So the purpose is that you read these tensiometers, record those readings, you put a certain amount of water on your field, you go back and read the moisture sensors, and you start to get an idea of just how much water you really need to use on your field. Anybody who wants to go into a commercial operation, water use can become really important in terms of whether they're able to turn a profit or to produce the kind of crop that they desire. It helps people figure out how much water do they need. If they decide they want to add another half acre to their farm, do they have the capability to keep that area irrigated? And of course, if you're under high tunnels, you can't count on any rain hitting the ground directly. It's very helpful to know just how much water you're going to need.
So people can just reach out to NRCS. Are there any eligibility requirements? How does that work?
We work with private landowners or operators that have a lease. If a person is interested in irrigation, before we can offer financial assistance, there needs to be 2 years of irrigation history on the field that we'd be working on. And that can be from your memory. We understand that most people don't keep records from the outset, what you grew and that how you irrigated. For high tunnels, we need to see a year of production. One thing I would like to say, with NRCS, each of our practices has a lifespan. And if you decide you would like to enter into a contract with NRCS, when you sign the contract, you agree to maintain any practices we help install for the lifetime of the practice. Some of the irrigation practices, like pipeline, has a 20-year lifespan. A pump has a 15-year lifespan. The micro irrigation system has a 15-year lifespan. So it is a fair commitment to this contract that you sign. But we can also offer help that's just technical assistance, help you figure out what components you might need, what kind of system might work for you. You can go to the UAF Cooperative Extension Service under their publications. They have one on micro irrigation systems and others on irrigating your garden. Even though you may work with us, we may come out and assess your property with you, it does not mean you have to enter into a contract with NRCS. We're happy to offer technical assistance.
So people can reach out to you guys, have you come out, check out their property, lend a hand with this technical assistance to help people gauge what they can do with their land in the wisest of ways.
You know, there was one other thing that I didn't mention, and one of the benefits of getting a design for your operation is figure out how much water you have available, how much of that area can be irrigated at a time with sufficient pressure so that the water is evenly distributed, how long it might take to put enough water on, how often you'd need to do that. And those are just considerations. Looking at having an irrigation system, I would love someone to help me figure those things out.
Thank you so much for taking time with us today, Pam. You can always reach out to NRCS. Their telephone number is 907-235-8177, extension 3, or you can email Pam at pamela.voller, V-O-E-L-L-E-R, at usda.gov.
Hi, I'm Nicola Revelo from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of agriculture-related opportunities and other fun tidbits. Today's the final day of Homer's first annual peony celebration. Last chance to get in on the action. You can still sign up for a guided tour of Jocelyn Peony Farm on Diamond Ridge Road. Tours are running from 3 to 5 p.m. today. To reserve a spot, call 299-9090. Today's also the last chance to pick up a beautiful bouquet of peonies through Spread Joy, Say Thanks at the Homer Chamber of Commerce Visitor Center. This collaboration between the Homer Rotary Club and the Alaska Beauty Peony Co-op is all about spreading gratitude and beauty throughout the community. Pick up your bouquet of joy through 2 p.m. today. And the peonies are in perfect bloom for the self-guided walking tour, Peonies on Pioneer. Look for the signs on Pioneer Avenue. And lastly, Homer Council on the Arts is offering peony window decals for folks to represent the city of peonies with a fun art project at home. A bit of exciting news! The Alaska Food Hub, the Kenai Peninsula's online farmers market, has been so busy selling fresh, locally grown, and handmade products that they've outgrown their space and are changing locations. Their Homer pickup location will be moving from the Sister Ship across from Two Sisters Bakery over to the Homer United Methodist Church. They'll be utilizing the atrium area, the same space used by the Homer Food Pantry, which is already well equipped for food distribution. Great news for the local food scene. The week's availability is listed on the website at noon on Fridays, and shoppers have through the weekend until 10 p.m. on Mondays to check out the products and the farms and choose whatever looks good. Then they box it up for you, and you just pick it up on Wednesday at the Methodist Church. Super easy. Check it out. There's a free one-day conference for farmers who directly sell their farm foods on August 4th, hosted by Barn to Door and all online, featuring keynotes, along with in-practice speakers, exclusive survey findings, and breakout sessions to learn what's working for farms across the country. Key topics are convenience, quality, brand, and pricing. Interested folks can register at www.directfarmconference.com. And if you like this show, we've got another show for you. For more insights into Alaskan agriculture, check out Ag Matters Radio. It's produced every Wednesday in Palmer by Radio Free Palmer Big Cabbage Radio. Each week, Amy Pettit, Executive Director of the Alaska Farmland Trust, interviews farmers and other innovators advancing Alaska's local cultivation explosion around the state. Recent episodes feature Homer's own Lori Jenkins of Synergy Gardens and the Alaska Garlic Project. Hi, Lori! Susan Houlihan of Alpenglow Skincare. Hello, Susan. And Robbie Mixon of the Homer Farmers Market and Alaska Food Hub. Hey, Robbie! Stream it live on Wednesday mornings at radiofreepalmer.org or check out the archives for all sorts of great interviews with the movers and shakers in the Alaska food scene of today.
That's about it for this episode. I want to thank Don McNamara of Oceanside Farms and Mike Grotz for speaking with me. Our theme music is provided by local musicians Carly Conomac and Kevin Cope. Our outro music is provided by local musicians Kevin Cope and Ryan Black. As always, I want to thank Homer Soil and Water Conservation District for everything that they contribute. I want to thank Nicole Arevalo, Pam Voller, and Kyra Wagner for contributing content to today's episode. We have big plans for a future episode. We want all of your questions, These could be gardening questions, which we will ask a panel of experts, questions about the production or making of this program, your recommendations for future topics, or any other questions that we can answer. Also, if you are screaming at your radio because I missed asking the important question, your questions, comments, suggestions, and criticisms can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. The topic for our next episode is to be determined. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer.